What's up, people? Adam Hunter here. Listen, all you people who are supporting me on Rockfin, I'm giving you another podcast today. I did an interview with the great Rich Antonito, former UFC star, former Hofstra wrestling star, on The Ultimate Fighter. A lot of people are wondering what happened to Rich Antonito. I'm telling you, this guy is a great guy, and I know you guys are going to enjoy the interview. And tell everyone how great Rockfin is. Make sure you give me a shout-out on Twitter, Instagram. Tell me how much you like the Rockfin, because I'm giving you podcasts all the time now. So thank you. Hey, Rich, how's it going?
Adam, what's up, buddy?
What's going on? So we're talking to Rich Antonito, who is a former UFC star, wrestles for Hofstra, Ultimate Fighter guy, and now coach, right?
No, not anymore. Not anymore. I've been out of the coaching for a little while.
Oh, okay.
I've actually been working with Vitor Belfort on his group training company about 2 years ago. We started working on this thing, and that's kind of where my energy's been. I haven't been involved in MMA much. I was doing work with the late Howard Davis Jr. with his Fight Time Promotions down here. We did that for about 7 years, and at that time I was still doing some coaching. And then I still had one guy left I was coaching, but he went to the military. And since then, I guess I've been out of that world a little bit.
Now, what is the Vitor Belfort group training thing?
So it's called Belfort Fitness Lifestyle. It's a combination of boxing and kickboxing for, fitness and functional training, strength and conditioning. And we do all kinds of different, workouts from endurance, strength, power, and we target different movements and muscle groups every day, kind of like a sports performance based training model. But we do this in a fashion that the everyday mom or dad or even elite athlete can come in and take the workout. So we started franchising them, and there's going to be one opening actually in Boca Raton, and then another one actually up in Strong Island.
Oh, nice.
Around the I think around Port Washington is the first one.
There you go. And that's where you grew up, right? Didn't you grow up on Long Island?
I grew up in Jersey. I'm a Jersey guy.
Jersey. You grew up in Jersey. Your father was a coach, right? The football coach / gym teacher / All-American wrestler.
Yep.
And then...
He wrestled and played football at Indiana State University back in the day. He was a pretty prolific coach in New Jersey, and then his twin brother, my uncle, was one in Long Island. He was a teacher and a coach and a wrestling official and everything like that too. So
wow, so you were right, geared from the start. I mean, your father was going to put you in wrestling and football right away.
Yeah, He had to put me in something. I had a lot of energy, so. If they didn't have me doing something kind of physical, I get in trouble.
Nice. And then I read, so it's crazy because you were born in 1977. You're a year older than me, and you went to Hofstra, and I got recruited by Hofstra. I went with Tom Quaglio. He gave me my whole recruiting trip, and I stayed with this guy. I think he was like 40 years old when he was like a junior or something. He was this huge guy.
Mike Quaglio.
Yeah, he was this enormous guy, and he was telling me how Tom Ryan was taking over, and then half the team was like pissed at him because they were kind of not that great, and they were kind of fucking around. Tom Ryan came in, took the whole program, and he brought you in. So you must have been a really good recruit.
I don't think there was much better recruits than me. I mean, I was all right. There was really good wrestlers. I was average. And we had guys like, Eric Schmiesing and Roman Flazar, who were both two-time All-Americans. Rob Anspach, who was a coach at Hofstra for a while, too. We had, those guys were like the blue-chip recruits You know, but I got the opportunity to go there and wrestle everything, and it was great. I was an absolute monster. Tom Ryan cleared house. He came in, and I don't know, before I got there, obviously, and only a few guys remained, but he really built the program up in a very short amount of time, and yeah, and then obviously he's done what he's done at Ohio State and stuff. So it was pretty cool to be able to be involved in the first head coaching season all the way back in 96.
But how did Tom find you?
He had been looking around at people in Jersey and everything like that. I actually was looking at I went on a football recruiting trip. And what happened was I went on a football recruiting trip because I was going to maybe play football at Hofstra. But I also had an interest to wrestle as well. And they were revamping the program. Long story short, I got introduced to Tom, and I decided I wanted to wrestle in college rather than play football. I kind of had like more of a, I don't know, more. I played football for a long time, but I just felt like the desire to wrestle. I love the competition of it. So, and then obviously with Tom Ryan being who he was, coming from Iowa, I always, you know, I used to get pumped up on a Dan Gable competitor supreme,
yeah,
you know, video. I think all the wrestlers did. So, you know, to get as close to that as possible was pretty inspiring. And so I went that route, and it paid off, because then that obviously served me a lot better once I started fighting than had I played football.
But your roommate in college is Phil Baroni.
No. It was John White. Well, I had a couple different roommates. Teammates with Baroni. I was teammates with Baroni and Hieronymus. But my freshman year, I was roommates with John Weidler, who was actually one of the early guys from Hofstra too, who started jumping into, you know, MMA long before it was even called that.
Yeah, I think my brother used to sell cars with him or something. I think he like sold her his cousin or something. My little brother's connected with that guy somehow. How crazy was Baroni like in college? I mean, I know how he is now. What was that guy like in college?
Well, Baroni, I mean, he, like, before he ever got there, he was Mike Amoroso from Massapequa was on the wrestling team, and they were friends and wrestled, and all he heard was about Baroni, but he was kind of like a myth. And then I remember he showed up one time, and I mean, I think he looked like he was 250 jacked with like no fat on him, you know. And then like, yeah, that's Phil Baroni, you know, he's gonna come wrestle. Next year he came and he wrestled, and yeah, I mean, I always had a great relationship with Phil, but he's pretty off his rocker.
Yeah,
I mean, he was pretty unstable at times. But yeah, it was just part of the dynamic of the team we had. We had a lot of colorful characters.
Now, did he get kicked off the team for selling ecstasy to the football team or something? Or he tells us.
Well, there was like the one time. So obviously, like at Hofstra, there was like a changing of the guards. There was a changing of the guards at Hofstra University once. Tom Ryan and the new crop of wrestlers came in because the football team at the time were like the, you know, they were the alpha males on campus, and everybody steered clear of them, and just, you know, through the course of nature and alcohol, you know, people start getting into things. And anyways, the football players and the wrestlers, you know, not a lot, but got into a couple situations, and you know, the football players found out that the wrestlers are not people to mess with.
Yeah.
And there was a time where you know, Phil Baroni, I remember, something was about to go down with him, and he was actually, I think he had a fighter competition scheduled, you know, and he's holding he had like the promotional slip or flyer like in his pocket. You know, he said, "I got a fight coming up. You want me to hurt myself before this thing?" You know, it was something like that. It was crazy outside. But you know, that was just one of many, many Baroni stories. I mean, I remember one time he brought a set of boxing gloves into the wrestling room after practice the one day. And at the time, he actually was, I think he was like a kickboxing state champ or something, whatever he did. And, you know, some of the less clueless wrestlers, they put the gloves on and just ended up getting pummeled.
Wow.
But, you know, It was just like one of the, but you know, everybody started throwing the gloves on, going at it. I mean, we had a lot of tough guys on the team. You know, James Hieronymus, Jay Heron.
Yeah.
He was on the team. He was a tremendous, tremendous wrestler. And he obviously went on to have a great MMA career as well. We had guys like Dave Bravo back in the day. He started fighting like Pancrase.
Oh, wow.
Might have been out in Long Beach. They had like a Lou Neglia Pancrase fight out there that was like an underground fight, too, because you couldn't even do it.
I think I had a friend named Steve Kotler that was doing that from Oceanside. He was doing, I think, that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it was out. It actually was out in Oceanside.
Yeah.
Right in that area. And they did that. We had all the right mix.
Oh, my God. I could only imagine.
Characters that everybody started jumping into the fight game at some point or another.
Yeah, so you wrestled at 167 and 197. So you gained 30 pounds. Did you make it to Nationals?
Well, no. I made it. Nowhere. So I was pretty much average in college. When I wrestled 97, that was because one of the Brainiac freshmen that came in. I was actually going to be 184 pounder. And one of the Brainiac freshmen that came in was smoking weed all summer. Didn't really think that you got tested for.
Oh, wow.
For some reason, you're going into the NCAA. Of course, they're going to drug test you, right? So this guy's, he was one of the bigger recruits. He's a Pennsylvania guy, and he comes in smoking weed. Long story short, he ends up getting popped, for smoking weed. And like a week before the season, I'll never forget. I had got myself down to weight. I was walking around at like 184 pounds already. I was feeling good, whatever, ready for the season. And, that happens. And Tom just comes in. He's like, yeah. He's like, we're going to need you to bump up to 197. And I'm like, oh man, I weigh 184 pounds. So long story short, I end up wrestling 197.
Wow.
And I was extremely undersized. I was maybe 500 that year. I had some, I had some good matches that I wrestled, but I mean, we went up against, Iowa and Iowa State and Minnesota, and I was wrestling like all Americans. There was a couple matches I just got, I wiped the mat. The guy wiped the mat with me, and then there was some matches that I stayed in there against some pretty tough guys too. So
well, you got the most improved. You got the most improved wrestler, which is pretty badass.
Yes. Which that year I did get the most improved wrestler award, which was kind of nice.
It's kind of nice, but then again, you don't know how bad you were to begin with, so that means you still could suck, right? Even though you just improved. So
yeah, I mean, hey, everything's a journey, right? You do. I mean, it was at the time it wasn't always that much fun having to do that, but. Hey, it builds a lot of toughness.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, man.
Tom Ryan, it was amazing because, like, the mindset that guy could put in your head, I was, like, convinced by the end of the year. Like, at some point, he had me convinced I was a 97-pounder. So, I was obviously very hard on myself every time I lost a wrestling match. And I'll never forget, it was at, like, the conference tournament. And I ended up having, like, I lost my one match, and then I lost my. I wrestled back in the consolations, whatever. I lose a very close match, and I'm sitting there on the side. I'm sitting there on the bleachers at the end after reflecting on the year, just like, holy God, that was a long ass year wrestling up at 197. And finally, he looks at me. He says, "Hey, Antonito." He's like, "I think you're more of an 84 pounder." He just told me said that to me, and I remember picking my head up, just being like, "Huh." I just hear that, like, thank God, because all year, he never gave me, he never let me budge for a minute or think that, anything short of winning was acceptable. But it was kind of nice to hear finally that he acknowledged the fact that, yeah.
Well, I mean, you did it, you did it for the team, and you stayed in at the Division I program, and you wrestled the best guys in the world, and that's awesome. The fact that you did that. The fact that you said you were an average wrestler coming out of high school, and now you're wrestling the best guys in the world at University of Iowa, at 20 pounds up, shows you how tough you are and like your character. So
yeah, it wasn't bad. Yes, I appreciate that. So it was good. I learned a lot of things wrestling in college and gained a lot of skills and You know, it takes you to another level. Wrestling Division One in college, especially under a guy like, you know, Tom Ryan, and with the great, you know, the teammates that I had, they were, you know, they were as tough as they get. And yeah, we all pushed each other, like, you know, much like every other wrestling program does. You push each other to the limit and you get each other better. And it served me a lot better. My experience in college served me much better once I got into mixed martial arts.
So let's talk about that for a little bit. So you leave college. You're now working at New York sports clubs, right?
Yep.
And then who gets you into fighting? Baroni?
Actually, no. So I moved back to Jersey. I went about a 2-year span where I hadn't, you know, I wasn't doing anything athletic. I was lifting weights. I was working in the gym. I was lifting and just going into New York City on the, you know, on the weekends like most people do, and living it up, whatever. So I came across a guy and actually stepped into a place called Planet Jiu-Jitsu. This is pretty old school too. So there was a guy, Jeff Miller, came into the gym that I was working out locally in Florham Park, New Jersey. It was called Planet Fitness. Anyways, he opened up a place and a little jiu-jitsu school in there and started doing jiu-jitsu. So, of course, in college, we loved UFC. We loved pride fighting. We used to mess around. So once I was done, I kind of wanted to try doing that, you know. But I really didn't have any thoughts of fighting. I mean, we used to go to watch Baroni fight, and we used to go to watch some of these other big fights. And, you know, I just didn't have any kind of thought in my head that that was something that I was going to do. But I loved it. So I started doing a little bit of jiu-jitsu here and there, but didn't really take it seriously. And anyways, a little time passed, and I would kind of come and go. And I ran into this guy. So I was working at New York Sports Club. I was running the gym. I was the head trainer, fitness manager. And I had a guy that was in there who used to be a professional boxer, the guy Leo, the Italian Lionheart, Lloyd Kona. He was a big, this guy, I don't know if you remember the movie Death Warrant with Van Damme, but the guy Sandman Burke, who was like the evil guy in Death Warrant, Leo looked like him, but like if he mutated into a more scary form.
Oh, wow.
And then had his nose broken 3 times.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I mean, he's just absolute menacing monster of a guy. But an absolute sweetheart too. Once you start talking to him, it's all personality. So he was at the gym at the time, and we got very friendly. And he actually had started training some guys here and there, and he was the one that started kind of pushing me and prodding me about it because he knew I wrestled in college. He could see that I was pretty athletic, and he would just kind of keep pushing me. You know, he'd say, "Hey, Rich, you're wasting your talent sitting here behind the desk. You're wasting your talent." And he used to keep prod me like that. He had a real kind of particular sound to him too when he talked. So finally, you know, I had gone to a couple local events, and I was realizing, I was like, you know, I was like, I could take these guys down. I was like looking at these events. I was like, oh, I was used to going to UFCs at the time. I would go see Baroni fight in the UFC. Went to Atlantic City, went up to Mohegan Sun, and I'd see these guys fighting. I'm like, geez, you know, that's it's pretty intense. And then I went to the local fights. I'm thinking, I'm like, this doesn't look that bad. I can take these guys down and beat them up.
Yeah.
So long story short, I was like, I told Leo finally, he kind of pushed and prodded me enough. And I told you, I wasn't really doing much with myself other than working. I was trying to, you know, I was working, but I had a void from not doing anything athletically for about 2 years. So I told him, I said, hey, look, if you teach me how to box, I'm like, I can already wrestle, and I got a place I can start doing jiu-jitsu again. I'll start fighting. So he said, deal. So 6 months later, I started going back to Planet Jiu-Jitsu regularly and started training. And I took my first fight 6 months later, and it just kind of took off from there. I was very much into it. I told myself I was going to fight at least 5 fights and see what happened. And on my 5th fight, I ended up running into the guys from American Top Team down in Atlantic City and Ricardo Laborio, and they invited me to come down train with them, and that's kind of how I ended up in Florida and ended up with American Top Team.
Now, was that before or after the Ultimate Fighter?
That was before. This is like, so I started fighting in 2004, and in 2006 I ran into the guys at Top Team, and we had a good team by that time in Jersey. We built up a pretty strong little, we had a no-gi jiu-jitsu team, right? And we started training, and we had guys. So Jim and Dan Miller, obviously very well-known guys, and Jimmy just fought this past weekend in the UFC, and he was a top guy for a long time. Those guys were on the same. We were all on the same team. We all had the same little thing going. So there was a great like little talent pool out of the place I was fighting out of. But I needed a place where I could be, you know, around a team of people, you know, and consistently get that type of training environment. And so that was 2006. I moved down to Florida because I knew if I wanted to be successful, I had to go to a place that I'd be put myself in the best position to do so.
No, and some of the guys that you, I mean, so you go down to ATT. I mean, do you jump in there with Hector Lombard right away?
No, he actually came down like 2 years later. So I had gone down there, and I mean, there was already, you know, a tremendous team. I mean, we had like Thiago Alves and Wilson Gouveia. Marcus Aurelio was there at the time. Mike Brown was already there. Benji Raddick. I mean, Dennis Kang. I mean, I could keep just rattling off names. George Santiago. So there was, I mean, they already had a tremendous team. So I was able to jump in the mix and start, you know, training with these guys and learning from these guys, and you know, getting pushed in the practice room, which, you know, obviously that's the only way you get better is if you're getting beat up on or challenged. So Hector came down about 2008, and Hector's definitely a force to be reckoned with, and you know, he kind of came into the gym, and he's deceiving because he's extremely personable, very like nice, you know, nice guy. But once something happens, once you put the gloves on and you start training, and it's just like he's got, you know, two speeds. It's like off and on. And so I always had good training experiences with Hector because I could communicate with him, you know, about like, hey, let's not try to knock each other out with the 4 ounce gloves. You know, but there, I mean, he laid a lot of guys to waste. He laid a lot of guys to waste.
I mean, so, I mean, you're watching that, right? So you're watching a guy go in there with Hector Lombard, think he's sparring. He gets knocked out. And then is everyone in the gym just kind of look at each other like, now what do we do? Or does the guy get up and run away? I mean, what?
I mean, everybody, I mean, you know, you're in the gym with, I mean, you know, they talk to people, so it's not like anybody's concerned, but you're just kind of like, like, what the fuck? What the fuck happened to this guy? Like, you look over the guy. They got the guy, you know, 1 minute to stand and move. You're moving around. You're supposed to be doing the warm-up round. I mean, this is of all the things. Like, this is the warm-up round. Next thing you know, you look over and somebody's fucking knocked out. You're like, what in God's name just happened? They got the kid's head resting on, like, a focus mitt trying to revive him.
Oh, my God. Really?
You know, you're wondering, like, how could this happen? So, like, in the beginning, there was I don't know. It took a little time to realize. You're like, all right, this guy really only goes, you know, one speed. So,
right.
But whatever. It was, you know, was what it was. It added an element of surprise and excitement and danger all at the same time. That, I mean, you go anywhere, it kind of happens. But I always had a good relationship with Hector. I never had any kind of problems like that with him. And I think it's just a type of situation where you got to know who you're standing in front of when you're going to train, you know?
Now, when someone like Colby Covington says, like, Brazil's a dump and, you know, makes fun of all the Russians and, like, and then he goes back to the gym and it's all Brazilians and Russians, is it super awkward or they all know it's a joke or?
I got to tell you, I don't know. I mean, for me, I've been out of it. I kind of come through there here and there and I'll do a little jiu-jitsu or whatever. But, you know, Colby, when he came in, I remember when Colby came in and he was just a wrestler and a great wrestler and a really good athlete. And, you know, he really built himself up and came on strong and took his first chance to jump in the UFC on, you know, short notice fight. And the rest is kind of history. But he didn't really, I guess, more of the recent stuff, you know, I haven't been around for it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think. Probably, you know, there's always people who are a little overly sensitive. You know, they kind of get a little butthurt because somebody makes a couple of, you know, offhanded remarks. And you know, you got to realize, you got to take it with a grain of salt. I mean, it's all about entertainment value these days. I think that's kind of what Colby's doing. He's maximizing his ability to talk some smack. I mean, it definitely gets attention, but I don't know, you know, what ends up happening when he goes back into the gym. I'm sure, you know, there's the people that think he's, you know, they take it more seriously, and the other people that know, hey, you know, just take it with a grain of salt and let it slide.
Now, I mean, now you be some.
That's the nice thing about not having to worry about it anymore. I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff.
Now, you beat Jamie Yeager. You knocked him out. You beat Rafael Natal. You lost David Branch. You beat Daniel Roberts, who's a great fighter. And you lost to Jake Hecht. You lost one fight, and then you stopped fighting. Why did you retire?
Well, it was kind of a peculiar situation at the time. You know, I had lost that fight to Jake up at UFC 140. You know, it was a fight I was winning. And I was actually one of the first people to kind of get caught with those elbows to the side of the head against the cage going for a takedown. And, you know, I mean, you saw that for a while start coming into UFC. A lot of guys are getting knocked out with those elbows.
Of course.
To the head. Yeah, so he actually, the bizarre part about that, too, that fight was I watched a guy do it to him in one of the fights I was watching. And turned around and ended up doing it to me. I didn't go out or anything, but yeah, it was enough to get the finish. And so anyways, that happened. And then, you know, I had to take a little break because I had a little concussion. So I started coming back to training. I was supposed to fight Rick Story in Jersey, May or June of that year. And then I hurt my knee. I got like a bucket head tear on my meniscus, my whole knee locked. Right in training, and I had to pull out of that fight, get surgery on my knee, and then I came back and looking for a fight, trying to get a fight. Long story short, they kind of threw a short notice fight at me over in England, and you know, we kind of went back and forth about it, and that's actually, I didn't end up taking the fight, and I got released from the UFC for that.
Oh, that's such BS. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, so they released me. Joe Silva released me, and it was really unfortunate. And after that, I was, you know, obviously, you know, pretty devastated over the situation. But whatever, you know, you roll with the punches. I was going to try to fight down here in Florida, you know, try to work my way back in. And I had a fight scheduled. I think, and this was now would be, you know, February of 2013. I had a fight scheduled, and then I hurt my other knee getting ready for this fight. So after, you know, it took me, I didn't have any health insurance at the time and all that. So I kind of just had to switch gears and started kind of get myself worked back into a kind of workforce type life so I could, you know, stabilize my income, everything like that. And I don't know, at that point, it just, I kind of changed gears and just kind of kept going that direction.
Well, I'll tell you, man, I mean, you know, a lot of these guys with the CTE or, you know, they're just kind of, you have your wits, you have this, you got your whole life ahead of you, you're a smart guy, you seem pretty happy. So, you know, maybe it was for the best.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, you're right. I mean, the thing is this, like, everything's going to come to an end at some point, you know, and sometimes it's not always on the terms we're going to choose. You know, but life goes on, so you continue on. I made a decision for myself. You know, I felt like I could have fought up until about, I could still have been fighting up until about a year to a year and a half ago is when I started feeling like I was like, you know, like my body was hurting a little extra, this, that, and the other thing. And I'd be like, man, I would not want to be trying to train for a fight because it's just grueling. But I probably got out of it a little bit early, but you know, there was other things that I was interested in too as well, and I was able to work with Howard Davis Jr.'s fight promotion, so I was working on the other side of things, and I got to experience that, and I got to experience things from a promotional side. So you know, it was everything's a little give and take.
Nice, of course. Well, it was great seeing you at the show, even though there was like some drunk guy that I thought was with you, who wasn't, who just kept buying you and all your friends drinks over and over again.
Oh, man.
And then at the end, he was like cursing to you. And I was like, this guy might get knocked out. Like, this is just some annoying guy. He was like right out of Central Casting from wanted to be in Goodfellas. And whatever happened with that guy?
Well, man, it was, well, first and foremost, I absolutely enjoyed your show. You're hilarious.
Oh, thanks, man.
You're the king of one-liners. That was, we had a blast.
Oh, thank
and,
you.
It was definitely a pleasure being able to see up front and personal like that. But it turned out, they told us afterwards, this poor guy. So we're gonna feel a little bad here. His son, I guess, passed away recently. I think it was an accident or an overdose, something like that. And they had told us, they said, yeah, this guy comes in. I guess he would go there a lot, quite a bit, but obviously he took a turn once his son passed, and that's why he's kind of been acting the way he's acting. And this random guy buying us all these drinks, and he's very, I mean, you gotta be used to that though, right?
Well, yeah, but I thought he was one of your friends, so I was like, I didn't want to mess with him too much, but he just kept talking, and then I just kept slamming him. And then when I realized he wasn't one of your friends, I was like, oh, I would have been a lot meaner to him, you know?
Cause he sat down very comfortably, right? You would have thought that he was with us, the way he sat down so casually with us as well.
Yeah, but then when he started, like, it was Mikey Rod, the boxing coach over there, when he started, like, saying stuff to his sister, I'm like, this might not be good. You don't want to mess with the, you know, American top team boxing coach. His sister, you know, but it was crazy.
Yeah, you had a tough crowd as far as percentage wise was that night, right?
Well, I was in Boca Raton on Passover, and it wasn't exactly the best time to be in Boca.
Chaz Skelly.
Oh yeah, and Chaz was there. I can't believe Chaz makes 55. Look, he was like 255.
Yeah, I know. He actually looks. Oh man, the name of the guy is going to blank me. He kind of looks like the guy who's the comedian or actor that was in he's in Dumb and Dumber. He pulls the guys over and he drinks the piss. He kind of looks like that
like
guy.
Oh yeah, like Harlan Williams. Yeah, he kind of does look like Harlan Williams. Yeah, yeah.
Looks like kind of like a bizarro Harlan Williams. And then he was sitting with that tall. What was his name? Tall Steve, the Bellator guy.
Yeah, Tall Steve.
That guy looks like. I mean, when I saw that guy, he looked like a hybrid of like the guy who plays. And like Alexander Gustafsson,
totally.
If they had like a fucking like blended and had a kid.
No, I actually posted like me and Tall Steve, and then Stefan Struve was like, "Who the fuck is that guy?" But I guess they're friends. So that was kind of funny, but cool, man. So are you married? You have kids? What's the deal?
Nah, man, no kids. I have. I live with my wonderful girlfriend, and we've been together for about four or five years, and so we're living together. Yeah, we're going to get married. We're going to have some kids before I get too old. And, I'll be 42 in June, so 42 years young, but,
it's all good.
I want to be able to keep up. She's young. She's much younger, so it'll work out.
Same, my wife's 28, so, She told me she likes Little Pump. I thought she meant like a breast pump. I didn't even know she meant like the rapper. So I know exactly what you mean, man. I know exactly what you mean.
It's more natural like that. It's hilarious. You have so many funny jokes, so many self-deprecating jokes. How does your wife like your bits?
At first she hated me. Like on our first date, she was at my comedy show, and her friends were like, "You'd better not be with this guy." It almost went really bad. My dad was there, and he's like, "If she stays with you, marry her." But now she likes it. She likes it. You know, she's got kind of a funny, like a goofy sense of humor, but she's cool. Like she's a really good sport about it, which is cool. And like, you know, she knows how I treat her like in real life versus like the stage persona. So she's cool.
Well, some girls they get sensitive maybe over the joke. You got to go back and like answer for shit after you tell the joke. You're just like, yo, I'm just trying to make people laugh.
Yeah, she doesn't care about that as much. I mean, she doesn't like. I almost think there'd be nothing really, except for maybe some of her family members that would be off limit totally. So, but her she's like, her family's pretty Christian, so they don't like my stuff anyway. So it's
right.
I don't really have to worry that much. But as long, you know, she likes it. It's fun. Like when I travel, she goes to me, you know, like to Vegas or whatever, like the fun places. She won't go with me to like Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or something.
Amish country.
Yeah, I almost went to FNM, their wrestling team. That's how I know Lancaster. But
nice.
But listen, man, it was an honor having you on the show. Keep up the good work. And next time I'm in Florida, let's definitely hang out.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me. You've brought me back to some kind of relevancy by having me on the podcast. And appreciate it, man. Keep doing your thing. I'll be looking out for you.
Thanks, brother. Take care.
Түүний сонс дөхөгч юм дур булаан. Даваа стоотан дур булаа мууруулаа.